Hello and welcome to the programme. 2007 was the European Year of Equal Opportunities for All, and to mark the success or otherwise of that initiative, this week's Network Europe is about discrimination. Coming up, why so many minority groups are between a rock and a hard place.
Many societies are asking minorities to integrate, but at the same time the doors are being closed in the labour market.
In France, it pays to hide your ethnicity, but only for so long.
First of all, I sent my CVs without photo. I had 2 or 3 interviews per week. I put my photo on my CV and I received perhaps 1 interview in 3 months.
In Sweden, new research shows if your name sounds foreign, you're less likely to get through the door. And we even have discrimination from the world of fashion.
There's always got to be a reason to put a black girl in a shoot. And generally, the poor things, it's something like a safari theme.
All of that and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters, coming to you this week from Hilversum in Holland with me, Richard Walker. How to make Europe a better place for everyone. Eradicate discrimination of all kinds against ethnic minorities, against women, against people with disabilities. Achievable goal or pipe dream? European political leaders hope the former and have assigned 2007 as the European Year of Equal Opportunities for All. And they haven't just given it a name, they've backed it up with some cash. 15 million euros from the EU, money that's been added to at the national level. Bridget Degen is from the Equal Opportunities Initiative and she joins me now. Bridget, what is this initiative supposed to do?
The year is about raising awareness about the rights to a life free of discrimination and to promote equal opportunities, and then also start a debate or reinforce a debate wherever it already existed, but start a debate, for example, in post-communist countries.
So who are you trying to raise awareness among? Because nothing sends people to sleep quicker than a dry document coming from Brussels telling everybody to behave in a different way to the way they have been used to behaving.
I think that we were aiming at raising awareness of the wider public, but of course the message didn't come directly from Brussels. It's not Moscow or the Kremlin. It was really a decentralized activity where we wanted to be as close as possible to the people, which means that more than half of the funding that was available for the year was given to the member states and to national implementing bodies to first implement the year. A lot of the activities have been media campaign. We have been organizing a friendly competition among the member states where they were able to show what they produced as promotional material. Poland received the first prize for audiovisual. They have designed a clip that will be shown on TVs to show that discrimination starts with the early age, and they show children repeating sentences they've heard their parents pronouncing, which are offensive sentences, and the end of the clip is to say, please behave because you are teaching your children already. And to fight against discrimination means that families, people themselves need to behave and need to think about what they are telling their children.
Thanks very much, Bridget. We'll hear more from Bridget Degen later on in the programme. To illustrate the initiative we were just talking about, here's a short promo made by the Council of Europe aimed at raising awareness of the many issues surrounding discrimination.
We are all different and we are all equal. If we work together, we can try and make equality a reality. For the chance to win a fantastic trip to European city of your choice, join us at eudiversity.com and show us what equality means to you.
Well, it cuts off like that on the website, but apart from that, it's a well-made piece and it puts you in mind of a TV advert for some youthful brand of clothing. But how well does this sort of thing raise awareness? Or engage the people who matter, employers with the power to decide who gets an opportunity and who doesn't. Perhaps it's time to look more closely at the areas where discrimination is a fact of life. One minority group not enjoying opportunities in France is black women in the fashion industry. But one of the world's biggest modelling agencies, Elite, is making an effort to set a positive example. The Paris-based employers of Claudia Schiffer and Cindy Crawford say they want to sign up more ethnic talent. So how ready is France for its large African origin population to be represented on its catwalks, TV ads and magazine covers? For Network Europe, John Lawrenson has been finding out.
Nawal, a breathtakingly beautiful 19-year-old who calls herself Algerian, stands in the queue, her number pinned to her chest, waiting for her chance to walk, like a model, down an improvised catwalk in front of the judges from Elite, France's premier modelling agency. Rosny-sous-Bois, in the heart of the riot-hit Paris suburbs, is an unlikely place to come in search of beauty, and an equally unlikely place to come in search of opportunity. But for Nawal and around 200 other girls who've come here today, this is her big chance.
I've always been fascinated by the fashion world, so I decided to try my luck today. It's not so easy for girls with a Muslim background. Some of my family said I shouldn't even think about modeling, but it's my life and I intend to live it the way I want.
Three girls ahead of Nawal have just made it through to the next round. Elodie is 15. Her parents moved here from Ivory Coast. She dreams of a success that would change the face of French fashion. It'd be great to see myself or one of my African sisters in the fashion magazines. Girls can be pretty wherever they come from, but right now you don't see many girls like me, she says. In fact, it's hard to find any at all. Look through the current editions of Elle, Marie-Claire and Marie-France, for example, and you'll find no African faces in either the fashion pages or the advertising. To find out why there are so few models of African ancestry in the fashion magazines, I go where the girls in Rosny-sous-Bois dream of ending up. 12 kilometres and a whole world away, to one of the fashion shows in the catacombs beneath the Louvre Museum.
You made it! You're going to be famous!
After the show, I get backstage. The mainly East European models are slipping back into their very, very long jeans. I ask Carotte, Marie Claire magazine's casting director, whether she's used black models.
Pour moi, il faut une raison, c'est-à-dire qu'il faut qu'il y ait un thème, un sujet de mode.
There's always got to be a reason to put a black girl in a shoot. And generally, the poor things, it's something like a safari theme. We'll take the model off for a shoot in Africa so she can be in her element, as it were. But there really isn't much demand. In 20 years, the Greek edition of Marie Claire, for example, has never asked me for a black model. In fact, they usually go for blondes. Our craft magazine, Marie Claire Idée, has never cast a black girl, or, because I cast children as well, a black child. When I was at Figaro Madame 20 years ago, they even had a rule against filles typées, girls whose look stands out, which included anyone Asian or African.
Ah yes, back when the only black model anyone had ever heard of was Naomi Campbell. How things haven't changed very much. But does it matter what happens in the small and superficial world of fashion? Isn't the success of one black entrepreneur or one Algerian origin politician worth scores of Naomi Campbell's? The sociologist and Sorbonne professor Eric Massé organised a seminar on the media representation of ethnic minorities earlier this year. He believes upping visibility counts because it shows the way forward.
It's a form of recognition of the fact that they are in France, they are French, they belong to France. And if they are more visible in TV program or advertisement, maybe the fact that there is no non-white people among the parliament will appear more scandalous.
But getting minorities into commercials is difficult. For Mr. Massé, the advertising industry sees one thing when it sees a non-European origin face: commercial risk. So back out in the banlieue, isn't Elite getting girls' hopes up for nothing?
Une bonne alimentation avec du temps.
Tu viens nous
voir plus tard.
Je peux garder une photo, Lydia?
Oui, bien sûr.
Elite President Gérald Marie tells a North African girl to come back and see them when she's lost a few kilos. But if she does, and she gets onto Elite's books, would she ever get any work? Would one of the French fashion houses ever choose this girl for their commercials?
If your fragrance has more vanilla and sugar than a fragrance of a different kind, you may use a girl with a more ethnic temper or character. We have to really be ready to propose to the companies the possibility to choose beautiful kids in the new generations coming from a different ethnic. If we are not ready, they're going to have the opportunity to say, hey, listen, is nobody good enough? Let's take a white one.
On va continuer le casting avec les fiches numérotées de 26 à 42, s'il vous plaît.
Three more girls pre-selected, relieved and elated. But this evening there's another eliminatory stage and there are three more rounds in the coming months. And even if Elite wants them, will the market? For these girls, there's still a long way to go. Luckily, the legs are long. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Ronny Soubois.
Perhaps being young and beautiful is some compensation for not getting a break in modelling, but the problem of discrimination in hiring practices in France, unsurprisingly, runs much deeper than that. If you're over 50 years old, it's a struggle to find a job. Young women aren't hired because companies worry they'll go on maternity leave. And for ethnic minorities, the problem is acute. 2 years ago, an anti-discrimination law set up a framework to punish companies that discriminate. But progress has been slow. RFI's Sarah Elsas reports now on the case of a young black woman who's had enough of her skin colour obscuring her skills.
Marie-Noëlle de Chevigny is trilingual and has a master's degree in international marketing. She's French from Martinique and has dark skin. When I met her in late 2006, she'd been looking for a job for 3 years. She was having trouble getting interviews. A typical French CV includes, along with your education and work experience, your name, your age, and a photo.
First of all, I sent my CVs without photo. I had 2 or 3 interviews per week. I put my photo on my CV and I received perhaps 1 interview in 3 months. My CV without photo is okay because I have a name that makes you think about old French nobility.
Marie-Noëlle de Chevigny. Studies have shown that people with non-French names are 3 times less likely to land a job interview. De Chevigny doesn't have that problem, but she has others.
I collect objections. You know, it's like a cocktail of objections. I'm young. People think that I will get pregnant later. I am from Martinique. I'm a black people.
A year later, I decided to call and check in on how the job search is going.
Hello?
Hello, Marie-Noëlle de Chevigny?
Yeah?
Turns out that she's been able to get a couple of short-term jobs, but nothing that turned into a full-time contract. So she's now decided to leave France.
In France, I did everything I could. So I spent 2 weeks in the United States. I was very impressed. When you go to an interview, you are not afraid. You are not thinking about they will be surprised because I am black or whatever, because they just want to know what you can do for them, that's all.
On paper, France has the framework to fight against discrimination. There's a specific mention of non-discrimination in the first article of the Constitution, but it persists. In 2004, the government created the ALDE, the High Authority to Fight Against Discrimination. As part of the 2005 Equal Opportunities Law, the ALDE can impose sanctions on companies. 1,500 people brought complaints to the ALDE in 2004. That number almost tripled in 2006. Those numbers are still low, though, which has made some people, particularly job seekers, wonder what's the point. Jean-François Amadieu is a sociologist who studied hiring discrimination. He says despite the criticism, the institution does play a role.
Elle est une menace.
It's a credible threat to many companies who don't want to be singled out. In fact, many big companies criticize the ALDE because they're worried about the scrutiny.
One thing some companies say is holding them back is they aren't allowed to compile statistics on race or ethnicity, a measure that would have allowed it in the new immigration law was deemed unconstitutional last week. Amadieu says there are other ways to count ethnic diversity, though.
Il est tout à fait possible de faire des statistiques sur ce qui est autorisé aujourd'hui.
It's possible to count what's authorized, like national origins. A person with a name from North Africa, for example, is 3 times less likely to get called into a job interview than someone with the same CV but with a French name.
Embauche à CV équivalent.
People like Marie-Noëlle de Chevigny with French-sounding names aren't counted this way. But Amadieu says it doesn't matter. The name-based statistics are enough to show the vast problem of discrimination in France.
On ne va pas voir un certain nombre de personnes de couleur noire.
We end up not counting a certain number of people of color, but that number is small within the bigger problem. We're fighting against discrimination on a large scale.
Des discriminations de grande ampleur.
Large companies are starting to realize they need to change their hiring practices. But Marie-Noëlle de Chevigny is tired of waiting. She knows it'll be hard to find a job in the U.S. as a foreigner, but she'd rather face challenges there than in France.
I prefer doing hard job to find something in the United States for a couple of months or years, I don't know. I don't mind, but I need to go overseas. I need to see something else.
For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Paris.
Of course, this isn't an issue confined to France. The problem is Europe-wide. The European Network Against Racism has just published its annual report, and it makes for a startling read. Away from glossy ad campaigns trumpeting harmony and diversity, ethnic minorities still face a tough time in a highly competitive job market. Radio Netherlands Worldwide's Vanessa Mock described the group's findings to me a little earlier on.
The group says they're pretty disastrous in a lot of key areas. There's evidence in all 27 EU member states of discrimination and racism in many, many areas. Everything ranging from employment, so that basically ethnic groups can't get access to good or better paid jobs, housing, ethnic groups are less likely to own their own property, education, apparently there's de facto segregation in some countries, including France and Germany, because ethnic minorities are confined to certain neighbourhoods so that even school kids are not mixing, they're discriminated in the classroom as well. Health, policing, social inclusion, and basically the whole trend, the whole discourse on integration is also not going well at all. And that's something that Bashi Qureshi, who heads up the European Network Against Racism, the organisation that has just brought out this report, told us.
Many societies are asking minorities to integrate, to be part of the society. But at the same time, the doors are being closed in the labor market, for example. And if you have no job, you can't get to know people you work with. Or you can't have friends. You can't have a social circle. You can't have a social friendship. So there is this big contradiction that on one hand, the European leaders, politicians, the media, and public is asking visible minorities, people of color, to be part of them, but at the same time, they don't make any effort.
So basically, integration is a one-way system, is what ANAR, this Network Against Racism, has been finding.
Now, also in the report, it's been found that Islamophobia is on the rise. This is obviously linked to migration, but also, I think, linked to fears of terrorism, isn't it?
Exactly. Apparently, there's a very big concern, a rising concern, that a lot of people across the European Union are making this link between terrorism and ethnic and religious minority groups. And that's leading to a rise in Islamophobia, true, but against a whole range of other religious minorities. There's been a very, very sharp rise, apparently, over the last years, not just in 2006, of violent crime, violence in general against perpetrated by far-right groups, and that these types of attacks are also not being tackled effectively by various national governments. But here's Bashi Qureshi spelling out just how widespread the problem of Islamophobia is.
Since this 5-6 years, since 9/11, it has become very obvious. Many Muslim women get their scarf taken off. Children are beaten up in school. They tell them, you Muslims are terrorists, you know. And many countries are now, for example, making laws against terrorism in such a wide areas that they are infringing the human rights.
There's also a concern, I should add, about also the rise of extremist parties across the European Union as well, which has been obviously a trend in the last couple of years.
But on the upside, at least the far-right grouping in the European Parliament has just fallen apart, as we were talking about last week.
Exactly. That's one silver lining. But of course, that party was fairly ineffective in the first place. So it actually means that you get these individuals from different member states now being able to just do exactly what they want in trying to push through legislation.
Just finally, Vanessa, there are an awful lot of directives and initiatives in the European Union already aimed at restricting discrimination. Why isn't that enough?
Well, this is a question I actually put as well. And this group that has brought out this report says, yeah, and it's applauded these directives. It's actually been advising the European Commission and other national governments on just how to improve their laws. But apparently a lot of countries are not really properly implementing those laws, or they're not implementing them enough. There's lots and lots of shortages still, for instance, in terms of having independent human rights bodies that are not linked, for instance, to government ministries. There's, for instance, an underfunding of NGOs that would be dedicated to monitoring discrimination, all sorts of issues like that. And the problem is that the European Commission, which should be enforcing this legislation, doesn't really have the tools yet to do that, although apparently some moves are afoot next year, 2008, to try and beef up the law to protect ethnic groups and other minority groups in the EU.
Brussels correspondent for Radio Netherlands Worldwide, Vanessa Mock there. In a landmark verdict, the European Court of Human Rights recently ruled that the Czech Republic violated the rights of Roma children by placing them in so-called special schools for children with learning difficulties. The state has been ordered to pay the 18 families who took the case €4,000 each in compensation. Meanwhile, Roma rights campaigners are now calling for the Czech Republic to adopt positive measures to address the segregation that still exists despite changes to the law. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby reports.
No, ztratil to, že v té zvláštní škole jako je pomalejší učivo. Lehčí.
Marcela Mikova is a Romani woman from Ostrava in North Moravia. In 1996, her son Julius was 11 when he was put into a remedial elementary school. The Czech term is special school. Marcela and 17 other families are now celebrating the court ruling in Strasbourg. But she's still angry about how her child was treated. He could have gone further, she says. He could have gone to university. Who knows what he could have achieved.
In Ostrava, the statistics showed that a Romani child was 27 times more likely to end up in a special school than a non-Roma child. Across Europe generally, the average is 15 times more likely.
Geraldine Scullion is legal director of the European Roma Rights Centre. After Czech courts rejected the 18 families' appeals for compensation in the late 1990s, her organisation helped them take the matter to the European Court of Human Rights. It found their rights had been violated.
They said in practice what is happening is that you're not remedying at all the needs, or you're not addressing at all the needs of these children. In fact, what you're doing is compounding their difficulties. By putting them in these schools, they have a lower curriculum, they don't learn their numbers or their alphabet until a much later stage than if they'd attended another school. They're isolated from the rest of the community, so you're compounding problems for these Roma children in terms of their social exclusion, their failure to find a job in later life, their access to further education, and perpetuating cycles of poverty and social exclusion, which is to the detriment of the whole of Czech society.
Special schools as such no longer exist in the Czech Republic, having been abolished 2 years ago. However, says Indian-born Roma rights activist Kumar Vishwanathan, segregation has not gone away.
In Ostrava, if you stand by the roadside in Ostrava and you've watched the kids taking the 7:30 morning buses to school, you find a certain bus is full of Roma kids going one way, and that is to the former special schools. And you find non-Roma kids going the other way to the normal schools. Basically, the old special schools, segregating special schools, still continue to remain, although they have been repainted and the signs changed.
If that is the case, how should the Czech state tackle the problem of discrimination in the education system? Jim Goldston is executive director of the Open Society Justice Initiative and has been closely involved in this groundbreaking case.
The government must, one, end the disproportionate
assignment of Roma children to certain kinds of schools. Two, it must begin to track and monitor what are the numbers of Roma and non-Roma so that it can comply with its obligation to ensure that it's not disproportionately assigning Roma to certain schools. Three, it's got to deal with the issue of consent because the present practice of parental consent was clearly shown to be inadequate by the court. And fourth, it has to review the tests and the manner in which that they are interpreted because the court again suggested that they are clearly problematic.
What's important about the Strasbourg ruling is that it makes it far easier for plaintiffs to prove discrimination. They no longer need to show intent to violate human rights, merely the facts on the ground. And given the ongoing situation, legal experts are saying we could see more such actions being taken by Romani parents in the Czech Republic.
Who has more chance of getting a job in Sweden? Blue-eyed Sven or dark-haired Mohammed? In an ideal world, and many feel Sweden's the closest we've come so far, you'd be forgiven for thinking their chances were similar, but you'd be wrong. Several recent studies in the country have shown that if you have a foreign-sounding name, you have a 33% less chance of even being called to an interview, let alone getting the job. Radio Sweden's Chris Boswell reports now for Network Europe.
One of the studies, carried out by Kalmar University, sent out identical application letters to several hundred jobs in Stockholm and Gothenburg. The only difference, that one of the applications was signed with a Swedish name and the other by an Arabic-sounding one. 30% of the applications with Swedish names got a call back from the prospective employers. Only 20% of the Arabic names got the same. So, what's behind it? Is it out-and-out racism? Or more subtle discrimination where the employer might not even know he's discriminating, letting his subconscious attitudes affect his choices. Per Norberg is assistant professor at the law department at the University of Lund in southern Sweden. He's written a book about discrimination in the workplace here, and he says, yes, it does exist.
Well, the problem is big, and we do not understand the mechanisms behind it, but we know that it is there, and in our book, we assume that racism is not the driving force, that the driving forces are more of positive feelings like selective altruism, that people want to become friends with their employees and then they choose persons who are like themselves. And if a discrimination law is to function properly, it must be designed in such a way that it makes people do something other than they would have done had they acted on their normal impulses.
Current Swedish legislation means that, for example, now if you've got two candidates that are exactly the same qualifications, the same work experience, and even if as an employer you want to maybe pick someone with another ethnic background to increase the variety of ethnicity in your company, you're not allowed to.
That is something that has puzzled us, because if you do it the way you describe it, then you have made ethnicity the criterion on which you acted, and that is discrimination of the ethnic Swedes. And there is in the EC law a possibility to do this, we call it positive actions. But you have to have equal or almost equal merits. But in Sweden, we don't allow even that. And that is a problem. In our book, we try to focus on this, that you have to accept that there are discriminations that we can see on a group level, but we cannot see it in the individual cases.
Per Norberg from Lund University. But Paul Lapalainen, who's looked into structural discrimination in Sweden for the former government, wants to strike much harder. He says discrimination in the workplace must cost financially.
You have to figure out who's at the top and make them responsible. Politicians, bosses in companies, bosses in the public sector. The politicians say, well, the public sector should be in the front lines, should be the best at all this. They're not. And why not? You know, politicians can give orders to the bosses. They're the ones who hire the directors. If they point out in the contract that one of the factors in their future salary increases and their ability to retain their job, it has to do with their ability to not discriminate and to lead a non-discriminatory workplace. That's one way to do it. The other thing I mentioned was anti-discrimination clause in public contracts. And if you attach one little clause that says, anybody receiving this money risks losing the contract if they discriminate, that's going to create a situation where the companies receiving the money start thinking in advance. They start acting proactively to prevent discrimination before it happens, because their job is to not lose money. Again, these are very basic ideas that can be done at the local level, at the national level, in companies. But you have to look at who's got the power, make sure that they understand what the rules of the game are, and make sure they know they can lose something. Then they will become very proactive and will live in a wonderful world.
Structural discrimination expert Paul Lapalainen ending that report for Network Europe by Chris Boswell. They sounded like quite simple suggestions for a wonderful world, really. But I picked up on a hint of irony in Mr. Lapalainen's closing remark there. Well, joining me again now to hopefully decode that irony and explain why effectively putting a stop to discrimination isn't that easy is Bridget Degen from the NGO, the European Year of Equal Opportunities. Are financial incentives or inducements the answer, Bridget?
Here we are addressing what we call indirect discrimination, where the people have not the direct and obvious reason for being rejected when they apply for a job. We know perfectly this, and of course there was this issue of positive action. We will not redress the situation by only preaching and having the law.
But even at a lower level, positive discrimination is something that's resisted in member states across Europe.
Positive action.
It's yes. Resisted at a constitutional level, isn't it? In Sweden, as we just heard in that report,
yes.
You cannot use ethnicity
even
to positively discriminate, to increase the number of black faces.
Yeah, there were also cases promoting women in the workplace. There were, if I remember well, cases in Norway saying that this was discriminating men if you promote women, if you help them catch up in society or in jobs. I think we have other tools. The Commission, for example, is also funding trainings of business people to make them aware of the situation. And also, if you look from a distance, if you think about competitiveness, you cannot exclude groups of people because they are from a different ethnic origin or because they are aging or because they are disabled or because they are women. If you want to compete with the rest of the world, the European societies have low demography and they cannot afford having large groups of people excluded from the workplace. Only from the economic point of view, it would be a disaster.
That sounds all well and good, but earlier on in the programme we heard about a black woman from Martinique trying to find a job in Paris, extremely well qualified, speaks three languages, and as soon as she got to the interview stage, she was rejected and came up against one failure after another. She felt much more encouraged and positive about her job prospects when she visited America and was planning to emigrate there. It seems good that you're getting companies involved and encouraging them to think about this as a good piece of business, to have a diverse workforce. But the fact is, discrimination is still extremely widespread and is still a massive problem for women, for ethnic minorities, and for other groups. Don't you feel that positive discrimination and something much, much more hard-hitting than encouraging businesses to think a bit more laterally is what's needed?
I think your remark is real, and I know the situation for black women and multiple discrimination hitting more and more women in particular, whether they are from ethnic minority, aging, disabled. I mean, they really face discrimination against women is one thing. And whenever you have another, you have multiple identities, and these identities are additional grounds for discrimination. It's some kind of catch-22 scenario, of course. But I think the people need to really use the law. And I know this is tricky. I know sometimes the people feel in distress and they don't want to use the law. But these cases need to be addressed to the equality bodies, and in particular for race and ethnic origin, because the race directive is very complete and very progressive. So they really need to go to the equality bodies, for example, in France, La Halte, or in Ireland, the Equality Authority, and they need to use all the tools that are at their disposal.
Thanks very much to Bridget Degen there. Well, that's almost all we have time for. Would you like to be on the programme? Get in touch with us at contact@networkeurope.org and give us your opinion on any of our programmes or stories that you hear within them. And now, one more chance to hear this month's quiz question before I read out the winners on next week's programme. I want the titles of the three tracks that you're about to hear in this short medley. Yeah.
And so I face the final curtain. When I look into your eyes, I can see a love restrained.
Well, that really is all we've got time for now, so thank you very much for listening. From me, Richard Walker, and all of our partners across the continent, thank you very much for listening.